The final episode of Invisibilia's new season is out. They have a story about calling out abusers on social media, and they ask, what can pain accomplish? Listen to Invisibilia on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for On Being with Krista Tippett comes from the Fetzer Institute, helping build the spiritual foundation for a loving world. Fetzer envisions a world that embraces love as a guiding principle and animating force for our lives. A powerful love that helps us live in sacred relationship with ourselves, others, and the natural world. Learn more by visiting Fetzer.org.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being's Unheard Cuts. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Reverend Angel Kyodo Williams. Listen to our produced show with her wherever you find your podcasts, and as always, at onbeing.org. Okay. Can I call you Angel? Is that all right?
Yes, sure can.
All
yes.
Right. Okay. I'm delighted to have you on the other end of the microphone to meet you, so to speak.
Thank you. I should have put a little picture of you across the room here.
No, I really believe in also just, you know, in what the human voice can carry. And there's a real intimacy. I'm sure you've done ISDN before, I assume. This kind of thing without being physically present?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think there's a special kind of intimacy to it.
Yeah, you have to listen.
So, Chris, what I am still hearing, you're hearing it too.
Angel, there is one. If you look at where it's not up on top. It's just below the lip of the table. You'll see there's a little knob there.
Got it. Less.
No, so turn down the volume. I'll translate into.
Yeah, I got that. I was just making sure my hands were translating that.
Yeah, he's usually sensitive to non-technical people, but.
Mm-hmm. I'm pretty technical. How's that?
Okay. So, well, what I was going to say is that I've been following you and reading you for years, and I'm just so glad that we're finally doing this. So, thank you. My volume is fine.
Likewise, following and listening to you for years, I feel like it's like a very familiar voice in my head.
Yeah. Okay, I think we're ready now. Good. So let's just plunge in. Is there anything you want to ask me before we start?
Where are you located?
Minnesota.
Oh, you're in Minnesota.
Minneapolis.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cold.
It's cold. It's not colder than Brooklyn, though, you know. I mean, I know you're not in Brooklyn
it's
anymore.
It's true, but at times. I was in the city just a week and a half ago, 2 weeks, where it was below, it was quite cold, in the bomb cyclone or whatever they call that.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, it just helps to have a sense of place. Thank you.
Oh, okay. Yes, it's funny because... that's not funny, but it's interesting because I know what I want to talk to you about also is kind of this moment we inhabit. And across the years, I've thought a lot about, you know, how the show would have been different or how we might have launched it differently if we were on either coast. And since kind of 2016, I'm really grateful to be in the middle of the country. It feels like the right place to be for this moment we inhabit. But I do like to get to both coasts often. and you're in San Francisco now, right?
I am. I'm in San Francisco now. I live both in the East Bay and now also straddle New York and Brooklyn again.
Oh, all right. So I'd like to start by asking, this question I always ask in some form about the religious or spiritual background of someone's childhood. What I think is interesting about it is that on any given day in our lives, I think we might tell that story differently. And also what I was thinking about as I was preparing to speak with you is that the spiritual background of your childhood and the religious background of your childhood can be two completely distinct things. So really I'm very open to wherever you would feel like starting to reflect on that. Today.
Great. I would say that I had no religious life as a child, except the life, which I would call my spiritual life, was a relationship, particularly with Jesus Christ, through a huge King James version of the Bible, a white one with gold edges on the paper, and you know, was debossed with gold. And I had a very distinct relationship with Jesus and a kind of affinity for, I guess, what I would now say is his suffering. But no belief. I just was not a child of belief and a sense of trying to believe in anything that I couldn't connect with and touch. And, you know, there were things like the stars that I, you know, had the sense were out there and I could see them, but I was not a child of belief. And so my spiritual life has always revolved around a sense of relationship to others, relationship to a felt sense of who we are in relationship to each other. And I'm sure that that had a lot to do with my own sensitivity and acute sensitivity to my pain as a child.
Yeah.
But religion was something that for me was, I was either inserted into it or it was trying to be imposed upon me. It just seemed like a thing that people functioned inside of for this very limited period of time. And they seemed very concerned with how they appeared
right
inside of those religious contexts. But outside of them, they were entirely different. They could be anyone doing anything. And so I was quite sensitive to that disparity, the real disconnect that I saw between who people were in their religious permutations and who they, in my mind, who they really were, how they really were.
Yeah, that's very, I mean, I think that speaks to also what kind of child you were, right? You're perceptive. What you were observing, the level at which you were observing. And, you know, also, I remember in your writing somewhere you talk about that Bible. And, I mean, your mother left and your parents had a divorce when you were quite young. You were very close to your father. There was this moment where you, and I think this also gets at something that you're also very steeped in now in Buddhist tradition, you know, the truth that is told in these teachings and texts that may not be the most obvious thing or the most literal thing. I mean, I remember you talking about reading that story of Jesus and feeling forsaken by God, his father, and identifying with that mm-hmm. that dynamic. Mm-hmm. It's very striking.
Yeah, it really struck me. And it, I think it said about this antagonistic relationship with whoever his father was. Yeah. I just thought, yeah, if this, whoever that is, I don't care how other people are relating to him, to that. That there was the allowance of, you know, his child to suffer in this way, which of course resonated with where I was as a child and what I understood about my own life and hadn't yet been able to articulate, the sense of betrayal of having adults and the people that are supposed to take care of you forsake you.
Yeah.
And not having language for that, I could actually see it and resonate with it and connect with it and form a relationship and a bond with the witnessing of it outside of myself, even though I don't think I had a clear language for it and a real way to understand what was happening in my own life.
Mm-hmm. And yes, and you moved, you kind of, another thing that's interesting about your story is, you know, you moved between two boroughs of New York City, which to yeah. someone on the outside might seem like a very short distance, but it was like going to another planet, it sounds like. And is that right? Is that, you were in Queens, is that correct? And then moved to Brooklyn?
Yeah, I moved from Queens. And for people that are familiar with New York, they would know that, you know, Queens is quite, even to this day, there's a the sense of like ethnic difference is very palpable.
Yeah.
And that there are entire different mini countries from neighborhood to neighborhood. And I had the great fortune of growing up in an enclave in a, you know, complex in a development that mashed a lot of those people up together. And so I was exposed quite early to difference, and difference was a given to me, and I understood people as being different. So when I moved to Brooklyn, as I have spoken about before, it was really a shock because there was a much more, there was much more of a sense of like, we're all this and therefore we should be like this, and difference was frowned upon, or it was something to be engaged with it from a perspective of threat rather than a perspective of curiosity. So that was very challenging for me. And then when I went to live in Manhattan, my schooling was in Chinatown, New York, and so I was really, truly in a different world in for great parts of my life.
And then it seems that you were part of queer culture that was emergent. It seems to me that was just coming to have the nuance, really, that the word is holding fully now, kind of early on. Mm-hmm. And you've said that experience, as much as anything else, paved your way to the Dharma.
Yes.
Yeah. Say something about that.
We were at the. So queer was still a bad word as I grew up, right? It was a word that was taunting.
Yeah,
it was
right.
Meant to be demoralizing. It was on the order of faggot, you know, dyke, bulldagger, all of those kinds of things. And so we were right at that moment in which we were choosing to reclaim our sense of identity, including the language that was meant to turn on us. Mm-hmm. And so Queer Nation was an organization or a kind of a movement, really, that was coming into being at the time. And it did more than just take the name and the word back. It brought people into an understanding of what we now say LGBTIQ, all of the things.
Yeah.
We saw ourselves, we began to see ourselves as actually coming into a unified relationship to our identity as people that were collectively queer, that were marginalized altogether, and that you were gay, meaning a man, or a lesbian, meaning a woman, or any of these other things. In fact, even at the time, which I've often said, bisexual was not even, it wasn't a permissible identity inside of the cluster of being gay or lesbian. We had gay or lesbian, and then bisexual was very suspect.
Yeah.
And so queerness actually opened the doorway to all of us being able to explore our identities and the living in the dichotomy that operated as either you were heterosexual or you were this other fixed thing, but there wasn't anything in between. And so what we now understand as a much more expansive spectrum of sexual expression, orientation, presentation, performance was opening with that language of queerness. And for me, I think that gave me a language and a lens, because it was happening at the same time, through which to turn the Dharma over, turn my Buddhist practice over and over, so that it didn't exist for me as a not this, meaning it was just not Christianity. It was not the Baptist church that I was trying to get away. It wasn't solely that. It was all of these other possibilities and permutations that lived on a much wider spectrum than I think many of us that have grown up very firmly in some kind of a religious orientation, then we move or convert to Buddhism, and it becomes a new fixation. It becomes a new, right. Like, I am this now, right? I am not heterosexual. I am lesbian. I am not Jewish. I am now Buddhist. And I lived in a fascinating and wonderful, and I would never trade it, time that said there are spectrums, there are permutations, there are aspects of me that I can continue to claim that are clearly of their Christian background and Baptist upbringing, my Episcopalian time. Like, I can claim all of it, and it doesn't have to diminish any other aspect of my identity. Queerness gave me the language for everything I know about liberation and freedom.
You also, though, moving in that direction and moving into your Zen practice seriously, you know, here's one thing you've written, that not too long after your first Zen retreat, you said, I carried my tender grief to the funeral of my relationship with my now grown-up friends. So what was it that also had to die for this part of you to come alive? And maybe die is too strong a word. I don't know. Sorry.
It did, yeah. It did have to die.
Okay.
And that is very much a part of, it sounds, you know, mystical and mythic, and it's also just true that ways of understanding and attaching, to use a common term, to your identity have to give way to something new that emerges so that you can know the difference between what of your understanding of who you are, of your identity, of your orientation, of how you see the world was inherited, expected, foisted upon you, collected in the face of a sense of threat and need to belong. And so I needed for some period of time in my life to belong to this fantastic collection of queer Black women. And then there became a time that through my practice, I realized that in order to know who I was, that I had to release the tightness of that identity, because it, with the sense of belonging, it also came with some expectations about who I could be and who I couldn't be inside of that identity. And so Zen and spiritual practice is ultimately, I think, very much around developing the courage and the heart and the compassion with oneself to be able to shed identities so that you can emerge into a more nuanced understanding of what is at the core of you regardless of these identities. Which seems impossible in some ways, right? We're always relative to our time, our place, you know, the things that we know and don't know. But I think the Zen practice really encouraged this sense of, and you know, we have these koans.
Yes.
And one of the famous koans is, what was your face before your mother was born? And so this is an inquiry, right? And into, like, what is the core of the you that goes beyond your identity as being queer, as being Black, as being a lesbian, as being of this particular era and time. And you have to let things go that you kept yourself safe with, kept your identity safe with. I had to let things go in order to come into more fuller understanding of who I was outside of those identities.
And there's something in what you just described and the way you described it that points at how your voice in this moment we now inhabit culturally. I'm very taken with this book that you wrote, actually in 2016, Radical Dharma, which I think was a prescient book. It's very much about what we're living through, but you wrote it kind of in the middle of that election year, before that was all done. looking at our, as you said, then I think there's a clarity there's about this now that there wasn't then, about this increasing collective anxiety about transitioning from the first Black U.S. president. So focusing on that human anxiety that was there and was going to be there, whoever had won the election, you make this statement that I find so compelling and stark. And this, you know, I just want to delve into this with you. You say, we cannot have a healed society. We cannot have change. We cannot have justice if we do not reclaim and repair the human spirit, if we don't do inner work, as you say in another place, that has been underemphasized. That this is not, we have not trained ourselves to do the work that is upon us now.
No, we haven't. We haven't, and we haven't for, I want to say, in good reason from a particular perspective, to do our work, to come into the deep knowing of who we are is, you know, that's the stuff that bringing down systems of oppression is made of. And so capitalism in its current form couldn't survive. Patriarchy couldn't survive. White supremacy couldn't survive if enough of us set about the work of reclaiming the human spirit, which includes reclaiming the sense of humanity of the people that are the current vehicles for those very forms of oppression.
Right. That's such a huge statement.
It's hard. people always look at me in this slightly hopeful and furtive way.
Right. So let's talk about that for an hour. And I mean, I want to, you know, and you've, so also you have lived inside this dynamic. Obviously, you are also a product of this culture, and you speak very openly about having your angry activist phase, which is more than a phase. I mean, a very important formative part of your life, which is also a formative part of our cultural life, and of our cultural impulse to feel discomfort and leap to change and kind of want to leap over that inner work. Mm-hmm. Where anger and healing and these things actually reside.
It's funny, I was just speaking about that to a friend as I was on the way to have this conversation, that there is this place of vulnerability from which truly transformative action must come from, is what I have discovered and kind of wrapped my whole language and view around, is that we can take action and we can take very skillful action. You know, don't get me wrong, in any way, there's an enormous amount of advocacy being done, very hard choices that people are making to put themselves on the front lines. But without this particular place and location of a willingness to be flexible, open, soft-bellied enough to be moved by the truth of the other in whatever given situation, then it is not transformative. It's change, maybe. Mm-hmm. It could be moved backwards again, as we can see, the stroke of a pen.
Yeah.
But for us to transform as a society, we have to allow ourselves to be transformed as individuals. And for us to be transformed as individuals, we have to allow for the incompleteness of any of our truths and a real forgiveness for the complexity of human beings and what we're trapped inside of, so that we're both able to respond to, you know, the oppression, the, you know, the aggression that we're confronted with, but we're able to do that with a deep and abiding sense of, and there are people, human beings, that are at the other end of that baton, that stick, that policy, that are also trapped in something. Mm-hmm. They're also trapped in a suffering. And for sure, we can witness that there are ways in which they're benefiting from it. But there's also ways, if one trusts the human heart, that they must be suffering. And holding that in at the core of any action, of at the core of who you are when responding to things, I think is the way that the only way we really have forward to not just replicate systems of oppression for the sake of our own cause.
Yeah. Which means that kind of discernment is also about knowing ourselves and uncomfortably mm-hmm. knowing ourselves.
I think it's uncomfortably, it's actually uncomfortably unknowing ourselves, you know? Mm-hmm. It is this willingness to like keep being willing to come undone, to do what we can to understand the world around us and how we operate and what is impacting who we are and how we are, and to allow that to keep coming undone. That's what I think is really the paradox in the what is possible in from a liberatory standpoint is to recognize like, oh, we're not trying to become something. We're trying to unbecome. Right. We're trying to undo ourselves. And that is really what is most challenging for us, because we want to be known to ourselves. We want to be known to others. But the moment we try to do that, we're actually fixating in a way that traps us. So we feel both safe, but it's also confining.
So one of the words you used when you were writing in 2016 about what this moment requires of us is that it calls for pause. And you come from a tradition, a spiritual tradition, which is a very which has sitting at its core, mm-hmm. right? So we sit and we feel. You're right. I want you to unfold that a little bit, because this thing we're talking about, it's so countercultural. It can mm-hmm. so easily sound like this is about not being relevant and not attending to what is urgent. Mm. But sitting as you, and what happens in sitting and in pausing, is not about not acting.
Right.
It's a different move. So just like take us inside that.
Yeah, I love that. It's a different move. There is so much momentum to every aspect of what drives us, what moves us, what has us hurling through space, including all of our thoughts and even our own sense of our emotions, how we interpret any given feeling, any experience of discomfort, where that discomfort sits in our bodies. It's not just that we have a feeling of pain or awkwardness, it's that we then interpret that. And those interpretations, much to our chagrin, we come to understand through a process of observing them, are not clean or not free of all of the things that are impacting us outside. And so even our sense of what pains us and what makes us feel shame, feel guilt, feel awkwardness, feel put upon by people, feel disempowered, has to do with the external information and cues that we have received.
Yeah.
And they're moving at an incredible rate of speed. And for the most part, we almost never get the opportunity to observe them and sort through them, kind of like that drawer that collects everything in your house.
I have a few of those.
Where you say, oh, but wait a minute.
Yeah.
Someone lived in this house before me, in essence. And some of that stuff is not mine. Mm. Actually, this is not mine. That's my mom's. This is not mine. That's the inheritance of white supremacy, or that's the inheritance of generations of oppression and marginalization that subjects me to habitually feeling less than, even if the current situation has no intent to make me feel that way. In other words, I have a default, a tendency towards inhabiting this constant experience of questioning myself or feeling diminished by the circumstances that I'm in. And we have no real way of being able to discern what is mine, what is yours, what are we holding collectively, what have I inherited, what have I taken on as a measure of protection, of a way to cope at some point in my life or past lives that I no longer need. And sitting lets us begin to do that. It doesn't do it right away, because what we first are confronted with is just the assault of the amount of thoughts and the mixed messages that just inhabit our body and our mind and our experience on an ongoing basis. That when we sit, the first thing we're met with is not quiet or calm or peace. The first thing we're met with is, oh my God, who is in here? Right. And why won't they shut up? How do I get them to stop? And not only is something and someone and everyone speaking to me, it's mixed messages. It, you know, things don't agree with each other. I don't agree with my own truth. I'm having arguments in here that are not my arguments. They're someone else's arguments. They're my parents' arguments. Yeah. Sitting lets us just, first of all, recognize that we are this massive collection of thoughts and experiences and sensations that are moving at the speed of light, and that we never get a chance to just be still and pause and look at them just for what they are. And if we step back and we can see that that is true, it begins to make sense to us, oh, the sense of confusion that I live with, the lack of clarity, the conflict that I inhabit going into any, you know, particular situation. It totally makes sense, because there's no clear voice in here that I can hear, that I can discern. And sitting, that pause, allows us to begin to, first of all, confront that we are not a single existence, that we are a multiplicity of existences all going on at once. And then slowly to sort out our own voice from the rest of the thoughts, emotions, interpretations, the habits, the momentums that are just trying to overwhelm us at any given moment. And when I say trying to overwhelm us, that's really a key thing to understand, because that means that there's an us, there's a core and deep and abiding us that is being overwhelmed by something that's actually not us.
And that, and it's about becoming present to that.
Yeah. Yeah. And this amazing moment when you're like, oh, I'm not that. I'm not that. I'm not that negativity. I'm not that constant sense of being small. I'm not that aggression. I'm not the behaviors that I committed in my past. I am, everything is open and available to me to make choices about how it is that I'm going to unfold my life. And we wouldn't know that when we're just driven. It's sort of like, you know, there's like 18 people behind you. They've all got a hand on you, pushing you in the direction of their particular choice. And all you feel is kind of moved. And we mistake that experience as like, oh, but this is me. And it's like, oh, no, that's actually not you. And when you pause, those hands kind of rest, or at least we're aware of that pushing, that in that momentum. And we, when we become aware of it, we're like, oh, I actually have some choice here.
And you are a teacher. You are steeped in this tradition. And yet I also feel that you feel a calling to open the fruits of this tradition. As you say, you've said, you know, Buddhism for you, there's no question that it is a religion. Mm-hmm. But there is also Buddhist psychology. There is also Buddhist philosophy. And these have wisdom to kind of offer up to the world. One of the things, you know, and actually your first book was in 2000, and that's also a wonderful book. Being Black, mm-hmm. It's Zen and the Art of Living with Fearlessness, right?
With fearlessness, yes. And grace.
And yeah. Grace, with fearlessness and grace.
And grace. Mm-hmm. Which was saying a lot back then.
What? Which was saying?
Which it was saying? Yeah, it was a bold statement. You know, it was something really quite challenging in that statement.
The living with fearlessness and grace part, or being Black, or both.
Both.
Yeah.
Right. That we could live in. In grace. I just want to say that I think you know. Black America is not non-monolithic as it is, has persisted in an amazing grace throughout the history of this country that is phenomenal, that if any of us were willing to be just a little bit sane and look, we would recognize like, oh my goodness, how extraordinary that Black people in particular, indigenous people as well, could live the lives of dignity that they have chosen for themselves in the face of the onslaught of what this country's history has been and continues to be and continues to put upon them. So grace, I think, is a gift that Black peoples have inhabited for a great deal of time.
It's such a wonderful word to call out, too, as you say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But fearlessness is the really bold statement, because we're expected to not be fearless. And in fact, our fearlessness is dangerous and threatening. And so having people of African descent, of people that identify as Black, to choose fearlessness is a very, very bold and statement of defiance. And I remember Buddhist teachers being tentatively, or sometimes not so tentatively, questioning about the idea that in the book I talk about warrior spirit.
Yes.
And I could see their discomfort with aligning Black people with the idea of warriorship.
Well, and in your life, this is—I don't want to call it a line that you straddle, but these are identity. You know, being Buddhist and being Black; those two things. I mean, you know, I remember you talk about your first week-long Zen retreat. This lovely, where you say you there you were walking in circles, staring at a gaggle of white people's feet.
Yes, the things that stand out and stay with us.
Yeah, and I don't even think you wrote that. It wasn't even as a criticism. It was like, well, here's the reality. This is what I'm seeing. So here is this tradition that has offered so much to 21st century people. It's kind of risen up from thousands of years of cultivating this kind of attention and presence. And yet, this tradition itself has this very contradiction, which is, I should not be surprising, should it? Has this very contradiction at its core, in its American, in its Western manifestation of having been brought to the West, as we say, imported, mm-hmm. mostly by young Jewish people and some Christians who were white, mostly. Mm-hmm. What you have some very interesting things to say about how white culture affected, I mean, it's like, for example, the focus on meditation, which is, again, like what the 21st century West knows as a headline about Buddhism. And that this, fact, is not the primary practice for most of the world's Buddhists. So that it's a non-relational way of developing community, which is more, has more to say about us than about the ancient tradition.
Yeah, I think two things are happening. I think we are in the West, and yes, primarily white folks of a level of certain amount of privilege, because one would have to be of a certain amount of privilege to go off to Asia and bring package up teachings and bring them back.
But also people who had...
package up teachers.
Yes, that's right. But also, you know, when you talk... And I've spoken with many of them, these wonderful, these kind of mothers and fathers of Western Buddhism, but they also will describe this spiritual emptiness that they were uncovering in what they had handed as a life. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say. Yeah. So they... of some amount of privilege, responded to what they needed. Mm-hmm. And so it's not a criticism to say, oh, look, the white people went and, you know, made meditation important, when that's not what the rest of the majority of Buddhists are practicing in the world. The criticism is not that meditation was made important. The criticism is that because of dominant culture, because of white supremacy, because of the force and momentum of the orientation of whiteness as a construct to assert itself as the most important thing, that it has therefore made meditation central. It's asserted that meditation be central for all of us.
Okay.
So it's not inherently bad at all, and I benefit from that assertion. So I'm criticizing that, but the grip on it and the therefore denial of everything else that might be expressed and generated from these teachings in modern times, in modern society, but through a different cultural lens, are set aside as not the real thing, not the true thing, not the pure thing.
What would you name, what for you is in that ecosystem of practices and impulses?
I certainly think that chanting practice, right? Mm. And, it's well known that Nichiren Buddhism and what most people have been familiar with, if they've heard of black people practicing Buddhism, they think of Tina Turner and chanting Namo Myo Renge Kyo. And that we talk about Buddhism as being largely white, and actually there is an enormous number of people of color in the Soka Gakkai sect. But it's dismissed almost to the point of appearing non-existent in our mainstream, as much as Buddhism could be mainstream, magazines and media. Mm. We almost never talk about Soka Gakkai, about chanting Buddhists. We even call them chanting Buddhists, right?
That's,
as if that's
interesting.
Pivot off of the real thing. So we have chanting Buddhists, which means that by default, the rest of Buddhists are not chanting Buddhists, which is absolutely not true. And so that's the mashup of dominant culture doing what it needs to do for itself. That's what people should do, and that's what Buddhism has always made itself available to, is human beings being able to come into contact with the depth of their own suffering and using the teachings in order to be in relationship and find a relationship to that suffering in the way that they know how to do, so that they can go forward with a sense of compassion for the suffering of others, and end of story. And so it's been doing that and evolving in all of the cultures it has met with throughout time, throughout its existence, since Siddhartha sat under a tree and put his finger on the floor and touched the earth and said, I'm my own witness. But what we have now is this mashup into a dominant culture that has incredible impact and a spread in terms of its ability to affect the world and how the world understands itself and what's important and what's deemed as valuable and therefore not
right.
valuable.
Right.
We have this culture asserting that what I need for my suffering, what is best for me, is actually the most true and real thing. And anyone doing something else is not valuable. They're not they're therefore devalued. It's a capitalist orientation to even spirituality.
Well, I mean, you can see how that's happened in Christianity as well, right? I mean, it infiltrates
everything. Yes, absolutely.
Everything. I mean,
absolutely. Yeah. And we, you know, there's a teacher that talks about, you know, Christianity's meeting of capitalism and how that has altered, you know, the depth of the core teachings.
I mean, one of the things that is so useful about this book that you wrote in 2000, Being Black, is actually something it contains a very, very accessible and kind of this and kind of revelatory, I don't know, like, I don't know, rephrasing, I don't know, the way you can frame what it was that the Buddha started to articulate and see after that moment. And the first observation being that life is uncomfortable, which is such a simple sentence, and yet it really flies in the face of what American culture so frantically works against all the time.
That's right.
You know, I mean, it's profound because it's just, I mean, it's just so stark. You know, one of the things you point out, and if we think again about, you know, how this wisdom applies to our life together, to human life, not just to Buddhist life. You know, this notion of like getting present, becoming present to our discomfort and the discomfort of the world around us as the reality we have to grapple with, is that some of us, if we think about the discomfort, and there's so much of this now, right? Mm. It's, you know, I just feel like for myself and so many people, it's just hard. Sometimes it's hard to get up in the morning and look around. Yeah. And yet, in the face of the hardest things in our midst and many of them very old that have been building for a long time, but we can't not see them now. Mm. Some of us still have the capacity to walk away, to turn away, to forego that presence. Mm-hmm. I don't know, I've just been thinking about that, kind of carrying that around. And I think for you, on several of our really hard edges, or I don't know if they're edges, but hard places in our center of gender and race, you know, you've never been able to be that person who could walk away.
No, I think that what, you know, the idea, people have been trained, right? They have been trained away from their, what we would call basic goodness. The natural depth of human beings to be sensitive to the suffering of others, not just human beings, other species, to be sensitive to the pain of the planet, is something that we're trained out of. So we are moved away from that by systems that require us to deny the pain that we feel, to cover it up, to anesthetize it, to you know, Facebook or tweet it, to in some way diminish the depth of that suffering and the pain, so that we don't allow ourselves to be touched by it. And so when you say that people have the capacity to walk away, what I would say is they have diminished capacity to feel what they're feeling. And as a result, they walk away because they can't withstand, they can't tolerate their own suffering. Mm-hmm. So the walking away is actually a coping mechanism that is the result of not having cultivated a depth and breadth of feeling for what one experiences. And it's understandable that it seems like, why would we want to?
Yeah.
Because it's overwhelming.
This is this inner work that you said that has been underemphasized, and it is the work we have to do to heal society.
That's right. And if we don't do that work, we do get the other end of it, which is this hardening, right? This mm-hmm. shallowness of feeling that allows people to sign on to policies that destroy the lives of other human beings with impunity, that allows people to look for an excuse for yet another person shot in the street and left to die. Mm-hmm. Because the alternative for those people is to feel what they are feeling. And that is overwhelming without a depth of practice mm-hmm. to be able to allow oneself to both feel that suffering, to feel with it, to let it in, and to not be annihilated by it. And so we talk about compassion and we talk about feeling, and that's the lovely side of it. Less frequently we speak about the resistance to that, which is the fear that we will be annihilated, the fear that we will be consumed if we let ourselves know the truth of what it must have been like for our grandfathers, great-grandfathers, great-great-grandmothers to have to figure out how to live in the face of human beings being sold like cattle, right?
Yeah.
What had to have happened to them if we... And then I pose this question often. I got to a point at which I realized, oh, I don't think those people just came out of the womb inherently evil or mean-spirited for generation after generation. Something had to happen to them. Something had to orient them in such a way that that natural capacity that we have to recognize suffering was diminished.
Mm-hmm.
And the impact of that diminished ability and to incapacity to receive suffering and to hold it and therefore respond to it has enormous implications, and we see them in the society that we live in.
Well, right. And I mean, when you say it that way, that that capacity was diminished, it's so easy to look around and see how that happens, that we live in a culture of distraction and... we're constantly being given things to entertain us. Mm-hmm. There's so much that draws us away from that inner work that does require kind of facing discomfort. I mean, I want to also talk to you about love. I want to talk about love, but also the other thing I think about is that we're very reactive. We're kind of trained to be reactive, and we're rewarded yeah. for being reactive, and we reward each other yeah. for being reactive, and that's true on every end of our spectrum. And
that's right.
I think talking about not just how we cope, how we face that discomfort, how we become present, but also how we work with that in a way that is transformative mm-hmm. Is perhaps also something that we have been trained out of. So I mean, you right. first got thinking about love with bell hooks. I don't know. How old were you? And you already started your Zen practice?
Yeah, I just really started practice. And I had all of the, you know, expected and I want to say reasonable set of relationships to the world around me that, you know, told me who I could and couldn't be as a person inhabiting the body of a woman, the body of a mixed race, black identified person, the body of a queer person. And so, you know, I was angry and, you know, thought to hell with them and, you know, had the kind of like tightness and reactionary relationship to the world that I perceived the world as a place that had to be scanned for threat. Yeah. And that I was
and that was a reasonable, that was not unreasonable.
Totally reasonable. Totally, yeah. Totally sign of, like, huge, enormous sign of sanity, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, I mean,
And I say that, and I feel like it's important for people to hear me say that mm-hmm. because I'm not suggesting when I expand out what is also possible to coexist with, I'm not suggesting that those kinds of responses to the world that we live in under threat are unreasonable responses. They are signs of health and sanity and one's own desire as a human being to survive and to thrive.
Yeah. Yeah. And our body, we are equipped for that too, right? Like
we are
our
equipped.
Bodies
yeah.
know how to do that. They know how to protect us.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And that's why the spiritual path, right? That spiritual work or inner work, if people are uncomfortable with the idea of like it being spiritual, and you know, we have some that it's complex and it's
you know
the
yeah.
term, but just to do inner work, to attend to the inner life. That is why it is something that is an add-on, if you will, you know, mm. to just living an ordinary existence, because our body will take care of responding to threat. You know, we'll tend to our needs, our urges, our desires, and the inner work is actually to allow ourselves to evolve and become more expansive in terms of what is possible for us as human beings beyond mere existence and reaction to our existence.
Mm.
That's what it offers us. That's the promise. That's the thing that people are, you know, reaching for, whether they call it, you know, nirvana or, you know, enlightenment or whatever else one wants to call it. What it's saying is that, oh, we don't have to just be this clod of ailments reacting
right.
to what goes down in the room, trying to figure out, are you food or am I food? Or are you to be pursued and are you prey or am I prey? Mm-hmm. Right? And
yeah.
without spiritual practice, without inner work, that is what we are left to.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that that makes us bad. But spiritual work invites, inner work invites something much more nuanced, I think, and comprehensive.
And I have to say, I mean, I think we forget, but we may be remembering that, you know, the great, not just spiritual geniuses, but social reformers have used this L word, right? Love.
Mm.
And it was absolutely central to the civil rights movement. And I hear this word surfacing everywhere. And mm. also an attention to how we have to, and I think that's where you were, you know, how we have to revive it, how we have
that's
to fill
right.
it with mm-hmm. connotations that take in the complexity of us and the hardness of what's before us. I mean, you've been thinking about this, the role of love in movements, I think, for a couple of decades. And I wonder mm-hmm. how your thought on that, also what you see in the world, is evolving right now.
Yeah, I think you were pointing towards it. Bell, and reading Bell, and getting an opportunity to meet Belle also, gave me a lens into the possibility of love being something that I could, not only could, I want to say, that I had to bring into the language of my perception of the world, and that love was not to be limited to my bedroom or my family, right? Just people that I thought that I liked, that what I was doing in the past and what we often do and where our culture calls us to do is to use love to be a quantifier of do I have a preference for you?
Right? Yeah, that's really well
I have, am I aligned and in agreement and affinity? Are you reflecting back at me what I want to be reflected back at me? Mm. Right? And if you are, and if you're enhancing my idea of myself, then I love you. And Belle opened up the idea that that was a very limited way of understanding, and she still does. So that's a limited way of understanding love, that the way that I think of love most often these days is that love is space. And
Say some more about that. What do you mean?
It is developing our own capacity for spaciousness within ourselves to allow others to be as they are. That is love. And that doesn't mean that we don't have hopes or wishes that things are changed or shifted, but that to come from a place of love is to be in acceptance of what is, even in the face of moving it towards something that is more whole, more just, more spacious for all of us. It's bigness, it's allowance, it's flexibility, it's saying the thing that we talked about earlier of like, oh, those police officers are trapped inside of a system as well. They are subject to an enormous amount of suffering as well. And does that mean that we ignore the significant burden and unequal burden that is put upon oppressed peoples? No. But it means that love calls us to include the humanity of everyone, right, that we find ourselves in conflict with, even as we challenge their behavior, right, seek to alter their policies, to move them literally and physically sometimes, to actually move them, that we want to do that from a place that says, I'm not doing this just because I think my way is the better way, but to the best of my ability, and this is a constant act of one's own work, that I'm moving us, hopefully, that movements, hopefully, our movements are about figuring out how do we include more of us, more of the time, to be more whole and more complete and more in their capacity to love, rather than handing off from this side to that side, from left to right or right to left or Democrat to Republican or, you know, that ideally our movements and our great movements have in fact done that. They have asked of us to not only to shift the conditions for the people that are marginalized, oppressed, left out, under-resourced, but it has also asked for the peoples that have been in positions of power or dominance to allow themselves to be transformed and moved in such a way that we're now more whole in our human family-ness, that we're now more complete in the way we understand and hold each other. So it's not just a demand that we are able to vote, but that you see the humanity in us, which thereby opens up your own humanity, which thereby gives you greater capacity to be whole in who you are. I think that those things are, you know, missed when we sort of shortcut talking about King, or we shortcut talking about Gandhi, or we shortcut talking about, you know, what Aung San Suu Kyi was doing at some point. We leave out the aspects of their underlying motivation for moving things. And we make it about policies and advocacy when really it is about expanding our capacity for love as a species.
Yeah, that's so interesting to just focus on that word movement, because again, if we just take a reality base, you don't move people by hating them or criticizing them. And you don't always move people by loving them, but you don't have a chance of doing it with the other tools. But you know, I'm also so thinking so hard at the moment. You're right. Like we haven't even seen this aspect of that history, even the history that's not so long ago. I think about, you know, a conversation I had with Vincent Harding, who was one of the in my time, one of the great civil rights elders, before he died, and him saying, you know, when it comes to being a multiracial, multiethnic, multireligious democracy, we are a developing nation. We've only been at this 50 years. I sometimes have this feeling that we are only now growing into, with for many reasons, the aspect of consciousness here, what you're talking about, the real human work, without which those political changes are fragile.
Yes.
And I think, you know, and I'm talking to you, and I think there are many, many kind of movements, many of them kind of below the radar of what is making the news. But like, you know, Buddhism is, and what Buddhism has offered up to the 21st century is part of this awakening of consciousness. Which we have to have.
I think the teachings, you know, the challenge is, can we allow the teachings? I once gave a talk called "What We Have to Lose to Save What We Love," and it was a conversation with Buddhists about not being so fixated on being Buddhists.
Yeah,
that the teachings transcended us in our identity as so-called Buddhists, and that if we really wanted. And if we really want these teachings that are fundamentally teachings of what it means to observe being human and then to respond to that, I think that's what the Buddha did in terms of codifying a set of teachings. He said, oh, this is what it means to be human, that I have to be in relationship with the truth of suffering being part and parcel of what it means to be a human being. And that when I observe that and I accept that truth, when I allow that truth to be real and realized within me, that I suffer less, paradoxically.
Right.
And then I'm compelled out of that to know in my core, in my gut, out of my bones, that I don't want anyone else to suffer. And that is what we're calling Buddhism. And if we want Buddhist teachings, if we want what those teachings have to offer to do the most work, the broadest amount of work, the most depthful amount of work that they can do in terms of impacting our society, I think that we're going to have to let go of being fixated on calling them Buddhist. I think we have to let go of the idea that people need to be Buddhist, or that we need to, you know, peddle Buddhism or any of these things. If we want them to return to their rightful place as the teachings of what it means to allow ourselves to be fully human.
It's interesting you use the phrase, I'm thinking a lot these days about, because I try to take a long view of time, which I actually think is a real view of time. Mm-hmm. But it's not a news, it's, you know, it's not the way we work with time right now. And I think about, like, what will our age be called? So I'm, like, collecting ideas. And you use this language of the Great Awakening, which is interesting because that's also a term in American history for religious, Christian, particularly like Protestant upheavals. Yeah. There's a place in, and I feel like when you're this phrase radical dharma, radical meaning, again, we kind of have an imagination about that word meaning extreme, but in fact it's driving to the core. And you write about dharma, one which is it seems to me impossible to define, but you know, universal. What do you say? Right. What do you say? Universal.
Universal truth.
Yeah.
And that's why I leave it as a loan word. We have borrow words when we don't have language that's complex enough to make a simple translation.
Yeah.
And so, dharma is much more complex than merely truth.
Right. But that idea of something that is something embedded at the core, some wisdom, some piece of truth. There's a place where you talk about how this way you are living this tradition in this century is very much embracing of other kinds of ancient teachings. There's a place where you say, like the Dharmic religions, time is held as fundamentally cyclical, but like the Abrahamic religions, also attends to the linear.
Mm-hmm.
How are you? I feel that what you're describing and participating in feels like some kind of evolution. I don't know. I mean, just this is kind of like taking a very wide lens and going to a big telescopic level, as Maria Popova likes to say, a telescopic lens on the present. But just say a little bit more about that, because I think that also is calming in its way for us.
We're at this unique time. I'm surprised, actually, that more people aren't talking about it. I think I may have glimpsed an article, but that I disciplined myself to not read. But we are at a time so incredibly unique in human history where there is a meaningful number of us that are not driven by mere survival. And we are not defined by the work that we do or the place from which we come. We are able to be transient. We can move around places. We can create meaning out of things and ways of being and work that we choose to do. And we can recreate it over and over again. We're not defined by where we are or what we do. We can make meaning out of it, but we are not defined by it in a way that former cultures and societies that were limited in transportation and had a necessity to be able to put food on the table, and so we farmed. And so, we did a whole bunch of things that were about fundamental necessities.
You just inherited identities from all kinds of identities.
That's exactly right, which is part of our great conflict in this country right now, right? We are running into people, the conflict between people that inhabit an inherited identity with the place that they are, coal mining country, right? Mm-hmm. And the work that they do as a result of the place that they are, up against people that have values and ways of perceiving the world that have shifted because they're not identified by their place and the work that they do in the same way that location and a fixed place tells you who you are and how you be in the world. And that conflict and the values that come from those two disparate locations is the conflict that we're up against right now. We in this country in particular, but also in other places
all over,
in the world.
It's global.
We are in this amazing moment of evolving where the values of some of us are evolving at rates that are faster than can be taken in and integrated for peoples that are oriented by by place, right?
And also and, who are
and the work that they've inherited yeah, as a and result who are in of the, where they are.
Who are constantly who are in survival mode.
And who are in survival mode right. as a result of that. And so our values and what's acceptable to us, enough of us, is shifting at a pace that is just outside of some of our ability to even take in. Mm-hmm. And the problem is, that, I mean, that's always been true, but the problem is now we have a meaningful number, a substantive number of people that have those rapidly evolving values in confrontation with people that are understandably still working with the location survival-based orientation. This means a lot of things for us. This means that in terms of values, we can be more spacious, right? There are many of us that can afford, literally, to be okay with people that are really, really different. In fact, we can be curious about it because our sense of threat is diminished, because our identity is not prescribed by sameness and being afforded belonging because of sameness. Yeah. Does that make sense?
It does. I know you observe this as I do, that many of those same people, people who have much in common with you and me, I mean, some of the same opportunities also feel very threatened in this moment. So it's hard to rise to that calling.
What we feel threatened by mm-hmm. is the pace of our own internal evolution mm. being thwarted, because when you're on that journey of why should I be worried about whether Chicanos are in this country? Why should I be concerned about borders? Why should, right? We feel with that the sense of a belonging to something greater that allows us to make room for a great deal of difference. And we require it now because it tells us who we are, right? We are actually evolving into difference and the acceptance of more different, new. That's actually part of how we identify, and we feel it as a limitation and as a threat, therefore, to have these limitations set on us, where we're told, this is what dress you can wear, right? This is what bathroom you can go in. This is what border you can and cannot cross.
Yeah,
our own identities have evolved in such a way that because we're not merely trying to survive, I'm not saying we're not trying to pay our rent and everything, but because we're not identified with merely trying to survive, our sense of survival, our sense of thriving is embedded in a sense of movement and spaciousness and increasing allowance for more and more difference. That is in direct conflict with people that are in a space-time continuum that is still place-based, survival-based, get food on the table-based. Mm-hmm. If I don't cut off the top of this mountain, where will I go? If those people are not beneath me, how will I know my own value, et cetera, et cetera?
You sometimes do an exercise. We did this in your TEDx talk where you have you've got a room full of people and you have them stand up, and it's about placing a hand on the side of someone's shoulder and creating mm-hmm. pressure, and I think feeling embodied but also feeling the space around you and feeling the other people around. I'm kind of longing, and we don't have time to do that, but I'm kind of longing mm-hmm. for to end with you just offering some ways for people to begin. There's this wonderful notion that runs all the way through your recent writing that, the world, is it, for people who are not monastics, the world is our field of practice. So this inner journey is always intimately connected with the practice, which is all around us.
That's right.
Yeah.
Our teachers, as much as we love our embodied teachers that come in flesh and bone and sit on cushions, are really the people, the situations that we confront moment to moment, day to day, month to month, year to year, that incite a sense of discomfort, dis-ease, awkwardness in us. And rather than seeing those moments as threats to who we are, if we could reorient, if we could center in our relationship to ourselves as evolving, fluid, ever-expansive creatures whose role is to be in observation of what is that? What has that inspired? What has that called forth in me, that discomfort, that is speaking to something that feels solid and fixed and is now challenged in its location? If we could do that, if we could live our lives in a way in which we understand that our deepest learning, our deepest capacity for growth comes not from walling ourselves off from the things that make us feel a sense of threat or discomfort or out of alignment or out of sorts, but rather figuring out what it is speaking to us when we feel those things and what do we have to learn from that teacher that is embodied in that situation, that moment. What is it that we have to learn, and where is it that can we expand and grow to include that perspective, that understanding, that awareness? Not so that we become something different than who we are, but that we're evolving into a greater and greater sense of what it means to be fully human, to be radically, completely in the truth of the human experience and all of its complexities. I think that if we can move our work we're up to, whatever kind of desire that we have for our own development in life, to be willing to face discomfort and receive it as opportunity for growth and expansion and a commentary about what is now more available to us rather than what it is that is limiting us and taking something away from us, that we will, in no time at all, we will be a society that enhances the lives of all our species. We will be in a society that thrives and knows that the planet must thrive with us. We'll be in a society that knows that no one that is suffering serves the greater community, and that no one that is suffering is not an indicator of the ways in which the society itself is suffering.
I like that faith of in no time at all.
No time at all.
I'm impressed with that.
In no time at all.
You mean that?
I really do. I think we have, we are evolving at such a place, you know, it's at such a pace. Even what we're experiencing now in our society, we're just cycling through it. You know, we're digesting the material of the misalignment. We're digesting the material of how intolerable it is to be so intolerant. Mm. We're digesting the material of 400, 500 years of historical context that we have decided to leave behind our heads, and we are choosing to turn over our shoulders and say, I must face this because it is intolerable to live in any other way than a way in which that allows me to be in contact with my full loving human self.
Mm-hmm. You know, I felt very like you, as just because of what I pay attention to as we walk through 2016, I felt like this human drama is what we have to grapple with when this is over, and it's going to be there whoever wins. And then I felt a lot of resistance to that awareness, you know, in the last year. Like everybody kind of, a lot of people, you know, all around kind of digging down into the trenches. But now I'm suddenly feeling like there's some, I mean, there's something you said right after the election of 2016, I think it was Lion's Roar, you know, said, I don't have a lot of words, but I have a lot of faith. I know the road feels low and winding, and we seem to need the pain to cut to the core, to emerge from the sleepwalk of despair and feel through the numbness of disconnect and indifference. But if we let ourselves feel this, we will be better for it. And I'm kind of now feeling bad about myself. I'm feeling like I was impatient because this is, it's just to let yourself feel is hard. It's a lot to ask, and I do kind of feel like that is emerging. I'm just wondering if you also have that sense.
Yeah, absolutely. it's part of it, right? It is part of it. It's part of it to go through the fits and, you know, the denial. There's a death happening.
Right.
Right. There is something dying in our society, in our culture, and there's something dying in us individually. And what is dying, I think, is the willingness to be in denial. And that is extraordinary. Mm-hmm. The willingness to be in denial is dying in a meaningful number of us, the tipping point, right? It's like, it's always been happening. And when it happens in enough of us, in a short enough period of time at the same time, then you have a tipping point and the culture begins to shift. And so that there is enough of us that have gone through this pain and fits and, you know, denial and thought like, oh, we can, you know, change the election.
Right. Or that's all election. It's about.
We can change this or we can change that. We did that thing and then we thought we could just like resist our way through it. And then the onslaught just, you know, keeps coming. And then we thought like, oh, you know, all of these bits of denial. Right.
Yeah.
And then what I feel like people are at now is like, no, bring it on. I have to face it.
Yeah.
We have to face it. I also think what people know is that, you know, short of nuclear war, we'll survive it.
Yeah. Well, what a pleasure to speak with you. And this has been such a huge conversation. And I had so many other notes about things we could have talked about, but it's been amazing. So
it's so great.
Yeah. Thank you. And I hope I'll meet
you in
person
places.
One day.
Yes, I hope so too.
Yeah. All right. Well, again, thanks for making time for this. We'll let you know what's happening with it, when it's going to air and all that. Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.